trust is a fragile thing. It's hard won, easily lost, that much harder to regain. Trust is what lets you enter into relationships with friends, lovers, and business partners. It's what lets you walk down the street and do your shopping and go to concerts and sporting events, knowing that you'll be safe among strangers. You'll be fine. Trust is also part of what lets a democracy function. Trust in democratic institutions, formal and informal, in the integrity of the vote, the balance of power, the role of serious journalism, the idea that, while politics can be a dirty business, most people play fair most of the time. That includes accepting when the other side wins and respecting the rules of the game. It includes not calling into question the integrity of the very system in which you serve. But a new president is about to take office who spent years claiming that his predecessor wasn't an American citizen, when he is and always has been. Candidate Donald Trump said repeatedly that the system is rigged and that he might not accept the election results unless he won. He insinuated that his supporters should think about taking out the other candidate if she won. And since being elected, he has questioned the competence and integrity of the U.S. intelligence community. He's nominated heads of government departments who are on record saying they'd like to gut or get rid of those very departments. And he has regularly denigrated journalists, real journalists, while apparently staying sanguine about the fake news that his supporters shared around during the campaign to shore up support for him. Ironically, creators of fake news love Donald Trump because his supporters were willing to believe just about anything that made him look good and made his opponents look bad. Now, with unconfirmed reports that the Russians have dirt on him, he's calling that fake news. And who knows, really? Who knows what to trust?
This is a time of testing of our democratic system. And this is the first real threat we've had in a long time. And will the institutions and rules and norms be sufficient to keep us from falling the way of many other countries toward a more authoritarian leadership?
This is Thomas Mann. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a scholar who, for half a century, has studied and written about American governance. He's co-author with Norman Ornstein, who's at the American Enterprise Institute, of the book It's Even Worse Than It Looks: How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. The book came out in 2012 and went viral. They have a new edition that came out in 2016 where the title's been changed. Instead of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, it's now It's Even Worse Than It Was. It was a long time in coming, and at least part of it was deliberate. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad. President Obama had something to say about trust in his farewell speech as president in Chicago before a cheering crowd of 20,000 people.
Our democracy is threatened whenever we take it for granted. All of us, regardless of party, should be throwing ourselves into the task of rebuilding our democratic institutions. When voting rates in America are some of the lowest among advanced democracies, we should be making it easier, not harder, to vote. When trust in our institutions is low, we should reduce the corrosive influence of money in our politics and insist on the principles of transparency and ethics in public service. When Congress is dysfunctional, we should draw our congressional districts to encourage politicians to cater to common sense and not rigid extremes.
When trust is low and Congress is dysfunctional. Sadly, that's been the case for too long. Senator Al Franken, who's from my home state of Minnesota, expressed his frustration last March over his Republican colleagues' refusal to even consider President Obama's choice for Supreme Court Justice, Merrick Garland, a widely respected moderate.
The American people know exactly what this is. This is just underscoring the obstruction that we have seen since this president came to Washington.
Which has kind of worked for the Republicans. They now control both houses of Congress, most state houses, and then Donald Trump, while not a classic Republican, will be occupying the White House. That's a lot of houses. Tom Mann has watched and documented over the past few decades as American politics have changed and trust has been eroded in ways he says he wouldn't have thought possible when he started out.
Perhaps the most worrisome is the absence of acceptance of facts and truth, even science, but it's the dispute among elites and with ordinary citizens about what should be taken as the basis of beginning a conversation. Donald Trump has set new records in espousing all kind of thoughts that are patently untrue. And it doesn't bother him one bit, and he may or may not know it is when he's making those statements. It's kind of Orwellian. You know, up is down, black is white, and you can say anything. And because people have separated on tribal grounds and strong social and cultural and partisan identities, they tend to believe what they hear from their echo chamber and reject everything else. And so it's amazing the things that the public is convinced on that simply aren't true. And that's been fostered by a political party and a set of supporting groups, media and political interest groups that have fostered that disrespect. We talk a lot now about post-truth. The problem is less in the stimulus, because we've always had disputes that had lots of lies and untruths in them, but you hoped over time there were at least enough ordinary citizens out there who would be moved by just sort of practical evidence and logical reasoning and come up with the right thing. But now we see it's too tribal for that to happen, and that creates opportunities for very different kind of forces to operate in a democracy. And so that would be the first sign that I see. The second is really the breakdown in norms of what's legitimate and not legitimate. I begin with the acceptance by one party of the legitimacy of the other. We dealt with that in the election of 1800. It was really tough having Jefferson and Aaron Burr on the same ticket, and before the constitutional amendment, they both got the same number of electoral votes. So the contest went to the House of Representatives, and that was a battle that played out for a long time, but partly because Aaron Burr did not have the qualities that you would seek in a president, especially following Washington. Adams was, you know, another story, but no one doubted his acceptance of the system, with the exception of the Alien and Sedition Acts and so on. It turns out that Alexander Hamilton ended up playing an absolutely critical role, even though he was on the other side of this battle. He was a Federalist, not a Jeffersonian, Madisonian, Democratic, Republican. But he said, we designed this Constitution to prevent demagogues from taking hold of this country, and yet we're close to putting one in the office of the President of the United States. And so he created the votes that made it possible for Jefferson to be elected president. And this also was the first time we had a clear contest between competing political parties just in their infancy, and very strong sentiments about who was good and who was untrustworthy. And it was pretty violent and vicious back then. But we had an acceptance of the outcome of the election and a peaceful transfer of power and general recognition that we're all Americans and we have to work this out.
Except that Burr obviously held a grudge and shot Hamilton eventually.
He did get even. No question about that.
So let's move forward to maybe not quite yet this century, but the last century when you started studying politics. I'm just wondering what drew you into it.
Probably my father grew up in the Great Depression, had a high school education, was a union member, and then started a small construction company with his brother and sister, and it fell on hard times, and, you know, was a milkman and an insurance agent. But at dinner time, we talked about politics, and, you know, some members of the family were bored, others were really engaged, and it pulled me into it about caring about this stuff.
So you're talking politics with your dad, with your family at the dinner table. It sounds like you recognized, and your dad recognized in that moment, that this was not some abstract thing that power brokers did in Washington. This was something that affected your lives. The other thing that strikes me as you talk about it, and you're sort of smiling as you remember talking about politics at your dinner table, it seems like now a lot of people are sort of dismissive of politics. You know, politics as usual, government as usual, you know, there's almost contempt. And disdain. And it sounds like that was not your experience growing up.
Not at all. But you describe the contemporary reality in most households, I think. No, it was joyful. It was, there was never any notion of cynicism. It was figuring out, how are we going to do this? What we need to do? What's the role of government? And now, sometimes in family settings, if there are a diverse set of family members there, they have to stay away from politics. But my whole career in Washington involved trying to both understand and explain to others how the system worked and what was good about it, where the warts were and what needed to be changed and improved. I would always tell them that that's the key to American democracy, what de Tocqueville found in the previous century, that Americans, you know, were busy organizing themselves at the local level and really cared about solving problems and getting things done, and that however badly we might behave for a period of time, eventually we did the right thing, pulled up our socks, and solved problems. I studied much of this with my dear colleague and co-author, Norm Ornstein, for all these years. But as we observe changes in Washington, as the external political environment became very polarized, a new style of politician or anti-politician was elected to office, it really changed. The principal differences that occasioned serious debate and argument, passionate, but gave way to agreement in other arenas and personal friendships was not to be seen as too much ideology, too much absolute certainty. And that began to make our governing much more difficult.
Yeah. So talk about the project that you and Norm started in the late 70s, where you were interviewing people coming into Congress who you felt were going to have an outsized impact going forward, and about what you noticed with some of these freshmen coming in about a sort of a different attitude.
We had an idea to start a Congress project to really help people understand how this very human institution operates. And we started up a volume called Vital Statistics on Congress. We did all kinds of projects. But one idea we had early on was bring together a group of newly elected members of the House. This is after the 1978 election, to meet with us before they were inaugurated. And then every 3 to 6 months, we'd come together over dinner, tape conversations, which we said we wouldn't use anytime soon or wouldn't identify them, which were utterly fascinating. It was a way of seeing how individuals acculturate themselves to a very complex institution. There were some rather well-known people in it. Dick Cheney was one, Geraldine Ferraro, and Newt Gingrich, perhaps the most consequential. Newt tried three times to be elected to the House and finally succeeded the third time. Newt came to Washington with a plan. Newt had in mind remaking politics, most importantly of taking the Republicans, which had really become almost a permanent minority in Congress, dominated in the House from 1930 until 1994, except for two Congresses back in the late 40s, early 50s. It was so dominated, one-party control, not very healthy. And so it fascinated us that he thought in these terms, but Newt outlined a strategy to achieve that objective by basically destroying the legitimacy of Congress as an institution and the people who occupy it, and lowering public trust in government. He thought the only way to throw off the majority Democrats was to discredit the institution and their leadership of it. And he worked hard at it and created the Conservative Opportunity Society, some of which was substantive and ideological, but mainly he was out there recruiting and training candidates in the best ways to demonize their opponents. He criminalized politics using the ethics process as a weapon to destroy his enemies in the other party. The then Speaker, Jim Wright, suffered at his hands, and his legacy lives on. He really changed the way in which members related to one another, really made normal the attacks on one's opponent and the other party, of making the battle, the campaign battle, a permanent one, not a season for governing after a season of campaigning. Mind you, there were other forces at work that were playing out in the country. The civil rights movement had finally succeeded with the Voting Rights Act, and we had the enfranchisement of blacks in the South. And so we began a regional realignment. The old Dixiecrats in the Democratic Party, the anti-civil rights, but sort of liberal populist on economic policy, moved out of the party. And over time, the two parties became much more ideologically distinctive. Before that, there was much overlap in ideology and plenty of opportunity, room to make deals in the middle across parties.
So do you see a through line between Newt Gingrich and Eric Cantor and Mitch McConnell connected to race? Do you think that part of this demonizing of Congress was about the pushback against the Civil Rights Act?
Race has always played a major role in our politics, going back to the founding and the Constitution. Do I think this whole movement was nothing but a blowback against the mobilization of blacks? No. Do I think the South became basically the base of the Republican Party because of the appeal of Republicans to very conservative, anti-civil rights whites? Yes. So race played a role, but other issues were important as well. Part of it had to do with the size of government, level of taxation and regulation. But then after Roe versus Wade, abortion became an important issue. The tax deductibility of private education to avoid public school integration. The politicization of the religious community that became very active in the 1980s, and evangelicals had mainly voted Democratic before that, certainly voted for Jimmy Carter. They made a decision to join the Republicans, who were more attentive to their deals. And so that set up a dynamic along with race in which you appeal to different kind of candidates because you took the pro-life position on abortion and were skeptical of affirmative action and other kinds of equal voting rights and the rest. So there were a broad set of issues that came to separate the parties, but much of it was just identity politics, and race was behind a lot of that, no question about it.
Yeah, something I've puzzled over after many years outside of the country and now living here again, as I listen to the debates and I listen to what the parties say they want and then what they actually do when they're in power, is if the right-wing branch of the Republican Party got everything they wanted, what would this country be like? How would it be different from what it is now?
You know, if you ask that question in the 1950s under Dwight Eisenhower, or even in the 70s with Richard Nixon, it would have produced a very different answer than you have today, because what has happened is, one, you have a really hard libertarian Ayn Randism that really rejects government. The government is in the way of the engine of private enterprise, that poo-poos the whole notion of a mixed economy, which is what actually fired the engines of economic growth and prosperity in the 20th century. You know, a vibrant capitalism, but partnered with a government that was making public investments in physical infrastructure and scientific research and technology and education, and were setting rules to keep those market players from becoming monopolists, from becoming crony capitalists. A healthy capitalist system requires a strong role for government, but the newer activists and thought leaders in the Republican Party really didn't accept that.
Okay, so that's what they say they want. But from what you've read, heard, talking to people, interviewing them over time, do you think that they actually believe that these things that they're proposing are going to lead to a healthier economy? Or is this sort of a cynical exercise to gain and hold on to power?
Yeah. It varies. Some are pure ideologues, and they were reared on the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged and see this as their utopia. Others, more practically minded, see it as a way of mobilizing some public support from the Tea Partiers as a way of them gaining a majority and then delivering what they can and have to try to keep them on board. But if you ask the people who are voting for these politicians, the answer for most of them would be no. Well, we're not talking about Social Security or Medicare, and not Medicaid if that's where middle-class people have to get support for nursing homes so we don't have to have our grandparents living with us in their old age. No, we don't mean that. I mean, we mean all that stuff that's a giveaway to the undeserving poor. So, yeah, I don't think there are many true libertarians at the level of the average voter. And frankly, most politicians aren't of that sentiment. They're more practical. But there are enough of them that are pushing these ideas, and they make promises. And Rush Limbaugh and others hold them to it. Grover Norquist, you know, no new taxes, period. It's very destructive. I mean, these are arbitrary arguments, and there's no historical evidence that cutting taxes reduces deficits or reduces spending or increases economic growth. And recently, there's quite a bit of experience that raising marginal tax rates at the top level does not impede economic growth. In fact, our economy has grown more in the periods after tax increases than tax cuts.
Now, you have said in your book, it's even worse than it looks, which is now crossed out in the new edition, it's even worse than it was, that you're not particularly partisan by nature. But the book does make the argument that there is a false equivalency when people say a pox on all your houses, all politics, all politicians are kind of a mess and everything's dysfunctional and that's why we don't trust you guys and that's why we need outsiders to come in and shake things up. Why is that a false equivalence?
Because the parties aren't the same, especially in this period. They've operated very differently. They have different values. It's the Republican Party that has really tried to weaken the institutions of government and to break the norms of our democratic system. I give you two examples. When the Republicans regained control of the House after the 2010 election, remember, Obama had a unified Democratic government for his first full Congress, and that's when he achieved what he achieved, mainly, when there were Democratic votes to get it done. Republicans had no interest in doing business. But this was a time when, encouraged by writings of the so-called responsible leadership, the Paul Ryans and the Eric Cantors of the world, the Young Turks, said, hey, we can use the need to raise the debt ceiling, which ought to be just automatic depending on approving a budget, and it doesn't have any effect on policy. It just allows you to keep whole with your creditors. Most countries don't even provide for any kind of vote on raising the ceiling. But Republicans said we could take it hostage and use it to demand other actions by the Congress and by the president. And so they threatened the full faith and credit of the United States. And then in several rounds, beginning with when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House after the 1994 election, shut down government, allowed it to shut as a way of trying to force some changes on our politics. In both cases, it was really sort of violating the whole norms of how the system operated. And I suppose the most egregious example is what happened this past year, the last year of the Obama administration. Justice Scalia died of a heart attack. It was in February of 2016. The president looked at the situation. Republicans controlled the House and the Senate, required action by the Senate to confirm his nominee. So he picked a judge from the D.C. Circuit Court who had been revered by politicians of both parties, you know, whose roots were Democratic, but who was truly a non-ideological, non-partisan judge. Many liberals in the party were unhappy with him, but his judgment was, you make compromises. Democrats don't control the Senate, and the Senate has to confirm. And Mitch McConnell just said, absolutely not. We'll let the people decide in the next election. So we hereby say the last year of the Obama presidency has no authority to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court. He just did it. He stole a nomination to the Supreme Court. It was as blatant and open and forthright as could be, and raises the stakes. So now you're going to see an effort to act likewise. But this will be, for the Democrats, resisting what will almost certainly be a very extreme conservative nominated by Donald Trump. I mean, it leads to an escalation of war. And in this case, it's really been the Republicans who've been pushing it. So we believe the public was disserved by emphasizing the importance of equivalence and treatment. It doesn't mean you treat one fairly and the other unfairly. It means you treat them both fairly and honestly. And if there's real important consequential asymmetries between the parties, then we ought to speak up.
Did you hear from Newt Gingrich or Paul Ryan about this book? What kind of feedback did you get?
Fascinating. It was almost silence. You know, we didn't get as many invitations to speak to Republican groups as we had before. We had an avalanche of positive emails and calls from former Republican officials who felt we just nailed it, that their party had changed so dramatically and for the worse, and it was important to encourage a different kind of behavior among Republicans. But it took Harry Reid reading from It's Even Worse Than It Looks passages, the fourth or fifth time on the floor, that Mitch McConnell just exploded and said, those two liberals, you can't believe anything they say. You know, it was good for a lot of laughs, but obviously it sort of pointed out that they knew very much about the book and the argument, and many of them were quiet because they knew it rang true to them.
And they were trying to discredit you the way they tried to discredit Congress itself. Exactly. And belief in the media.
Exactly.
So we're speaking in the first week of January, and it's been an interesting time in the sense of the new Congress has just taken its seat, and one of its first acts, probably its first act, was to have a secret meeting and to vote to gut the Ethics Committee. And this was over the objections of the former Young Guns, who are now congressional leaders, Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy. And then Donald Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, tweeted that this was perhaps not the best time to be doing this. And so they've backpedaled. It's interesting when an insurgent group or people who think of themselves as insurgents have to lead and the responsibility is all on them and history will judge them for what they do. Are you expecting any sorts of adjustments to the ideology as they go forward? Is this, you think, a sign of things to come or just an early misstep and then they're just going to go full speed ahead with the agenda that they've been talking about for all these years?
It clearly was a misstep. Ironically, Norm and I had a role in setting up the Office of Congressional Ethics. It was one of the recommendations in our previous book of the need for some entity that doesn't just include sitting members to hear on complaints of ethics violations and to do the due diligence in gathering information. The Constitution empowers members to be the judge of the behavior of their own themselves. So ultimately, any decision is a decision of the full House or the full Senate on any punishment of individual members. And the Congress used to not even have ethics committees in the House or Senate. This came after a run of scandals in the 70s. But it was still very difficult for members to sit in judgment of other members. And so that's why we urged this other layer. And it was set up in a very almost sort of conservative fashion, so it couldn't be politicized. And it's operated really well, but some members have been caught in it, and they haven't liked being investigated, Democrats and Republicans, and would like to kill it. But Pelosi, who was the speaker at the time it was adopted, wasn't going to give in to Democrats complaining about it. She thought it was important to have for the institution. And by all reports, Ryan, he may not have liked it, but he saw its purpose, but he put it up for a vote, and a lot of members said, no, let's do this. They didn't actually abolish it, but they disemboweled it. And I'll tell you, the reform groups got operating. I actually think Donald Trump had less impact on this, and because they managed to stir up a lot of callers. Offices were overwhelmed with objections, and it may tell us something about what's to come in the weeks and months ahead. This one was a sort of bipartisan attack on the change the Republicans were making. Even there are a number of conservative groups, reform groups, that were very unhappy about what they were doing. Other times it may be strictly partisan. This is a very unusual period, and it seems as if there's a devil's bargain that's been made, that Republicans will get their most radical agenda, big tax cuts and dramatic changes in the programs of the social safety net, a diminishment of that kind of government, and kind of give Trump room to operate as a more authoritarian-like president. They were very quiet about outrageous things he said in the campaign, and even during the transition. I mean, his conflicts of interest with the Trump business is just staggering and fraught with the potential of scandal from day one, and yet they've been very timid about that. They worry about it. They're not naturally authoritarians. They believe in a democratic system. Trump's never thought about that. Everything is instinct and going on what he's done before, which is promoting himself and getting his kudos from public adoration and going after anyone who says anything cross about him. And no one really knows whether Trump actually cares about any specific policy. I mean, he's picked his cabinet in ways that suggest it's going to be very conservative and very disruptive. The people he's chosen mainly are opponents of the mission of the departments they will head, and his appointments skew right, but it isn't clear he has any strong feelings about this. Everything is based on personal reactions or experience a long time ago, and we don't know what we're going to have, but the worrisome signs, efforts to limit media access, potential abuses of the rule of law, using the institutions of government to get even with one's political opponent, the breaking down of normal routines of transparency and speaking through the media to the public. The constant tweeting is really eerie.
So in the book, it's even worse than it looks, or even worse than it was. You talk about some things that could be done to try to regain the trust of citizens in governance in general and in Congress in particular. Given the specific circumstances which we as a country now face, what can people who care about such things do over the next 4 years?
It's such an important question. And for the most part, I think directing one's energies toward long-term structural reforms in the system is not the way to go. What's needed now is direct involvement in political organization and mobilization. Our system is responsive if there's a clear sentiment coming from the public that isn't strictly divided by party, that manages to build larger majorities and threaten to hold politicians accountable. The Democratic Party will probably take lessons from the Republican Party of their behavior during Barack Obama's presidency, which was absolute opposition, unwillingness to engage in any bargaining or negotiation compromise, even if Obama offered them something they were for a couple of years earlier. Democrats don't like to do that. You know, they believe in government and programs of government, but also the processes of government. So they're not inclined to, but they're going to have to protect what Obama managed to accomplish and to make clear to the public what this agenda is in Washington now that doesn't seem to have much relationship to the basis on which they voted for change and respect and help from hardworking Americans who weren't gathered in the cities, who've been left behind by automation and globalization. Nothing on the agenda yet really addresses those concerns. So we're going to have to rely on people working through organizations in their own community and parties, too. I think the Republican Party needs new voices and leaders. There are a lot of people in the party unhappy with what's going on. Many people who voted for Trump thought Clinton would surely be elected. They felt he was unfit for office, but you know, I'm a Republican, I'll vote for him. It's not going to make any difference. Clinton's going to be president. That happened with Democrats as well. If we can't have Bernie Sanders, well, we'll just go home and not vote or pick a third party candidate or something. Now everyone sees the seriousness of the collective choice that has been made. And it seems to me it's a time for ongoing political organization, mobilization, communication with elected officials and state government and local governments and in Washington for new voices to rise in both parties. And Republicans aren't going to change unless their way of doing business proves harmful. And thus far, by being absolutely oppositionist, they've come to control both houses of Congress, the presidency, most governorships, state legislatures. They're on a roll now, and they're going to have to lose a lot of that because of the actions they're taking. So that's one step. But the other is, how do we protect our democracy itself? You know, there are populist movements that have succeeded in changing democracies into autocracies all around the world. And it all starts with a successful election. These are not coups or revolutions. And it seems to me one of the jobs, and what I will be working on over this next year, is trying to develop indicators and signs of what's illegitimate in American democracy and where it's appearing. And it's time for using public shame on such things and riling up people about the right kind of issues. And it won't be easy, but I think it's going to take a more vigilant public. Obviously, some people are not at all engaged in politics and don't care about it. The hope is there's enough of a more attentive, activist, concerned segment of the public that can be active and in so doing help preserve a democratic system that's carried us 240 years.
Hillary Clinton and others, in being gracious about Donald Trump's win in the election in the Electoral College, said, "We now hope for your success." But it's really important how you define success. And what Hillary Clinton meant, and what Donald Trump might mean, and what the young guns in Congress might mean, are quite different realities. So what, in your mind, would be a success at the end of these 4 years, and how big of a gap is there between that and what you expect will actually happen?
Oh, what a great question. Yeah, success is partly a matter of, hey, do the 25 million Americans who now have health insurance that didn't have it before still have it in some way or another? Does the Affordable Care Act get strengthened and repaired, or does it get destroyed? And what are the costs associated with that? Do we reform our tax code, corporate and individual, in a way that fosters growth and diminishes some levels of inequality that clearly exist in this country? Or do we have another huge tax cut for people who don't need it at all and put ourselves in a hole again? Do we maintain central programs of government that have broad support among the public, or do we begin to unravel them by making changes that will ultimately lead to their full privatization? And soon we're back and everyone's on their own. There's no community together. Do we deal with the serious problems of immigration, of figuring out what to do with 11 million or so undocumented aliens, but who've been living here and participating in society and the economy, and perhaps setting the system for the future in a way that is more sustainable to everyone? So those are important differences, and you're right. I think all of the players have different views on what is a success. Donald Trump wants kudos. He wants to be big man in the world, and he's a very needy fellow who sees opportunities, perhaps, to see his fame skyrocket without hurting his wallet. I don't know anything beyond that. He's a complete mystery to us, but if we're still whole, if we've been forced to make some deals to keep some things going, and if we've reined in excesses by the new president that seem harmful to our government, if enough Republicans are willing to break with the party line on matters of real national importance, and whether we can begin to diminish the almost reflexive anger and distrust of the political system. Visceral anger at government is counterproductive. It will weaken our capacity to grow and to make real the American dream, to keep America in a position to help provide global security and keep our planet whole and alive. We have a responsibility to those who follow us, and government is absolutely essential instrument in it. Yes, together with a roaring capitalist system, lots of entrepreneurs, plenty of ambition, all of those are good things. But to have a prosperous society, we've got to have government, and a lot more of it than many people may think.
Tom Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So here's the thing. America has self-corrected many times. Sometimes it's been more of a challenge than others. The Civil War comes to mind, the McCarthy era. Coming back from those kinds of things requires active effort. This may be one of those times.
All of this depends on our participation, on each of us accepting the responsibility of citizenship, regardless of which way the pendulum of power happens to be swinging.
If we as a nation do manage to rediscover a unified sense of meaning and purpose and identity, an agreement about what institutions and facts to trust, historians may look back on this moment as a stumble, not a fall. They may say that up to this very moment, this part of the century was ours to lose. And if that's what ends up happening because of an own goal by one of our own political parties, well, to quote our president-elect, sad. That's it for this time. Comments, suggestions, drop me a line at whocentury@gmail.com. I'm also on Twitter at Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. You can see a print version of this episode and all our other episodes at pri.org/century. We're on SoundCloud and Stitcher, and of course, you can also download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, if you like the podcast, please rate us and leave a review. It helps others find it. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Until next time.